Cutting the Curd is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country? For more information, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Cutting the Curd. This is your host, Greg Blaze. A couple of weeks ago, I spoke with Susan Sturman and Stephanie Ciano about some current events in the cheese business. And today, we're going to address another hot topic in cheese, name protection and the importance of geography in naming cheeses. I'm very lucky to have two esteemed cheese professionals in the booth with me today. Rachel Perez is here, French cheese ambassador and member of the ACS Judging and Competition Committee, among many other cheese-related roles. How are you doing today, Rachel?
I'm good. Thanks, Greg.
Cool. I also have David Grotenstein in the studio today, better known as David G., an industry veteran for over 30 years. A fun fact about David is that he's one of the few people to have tasted the actual wheel of each best-of-show cheese at the ACS competition for the past 13 years. Is that right, David?
Up until this year. This is the first year I broke my ankle in the spring, and I missed the conference for the first time.
Oh, that's right. I remember seeing you. You were dragging a can boot around with you. Well, I want to thank both of you guys for being here today.
Thanks, Greg.
It's great to be here.
So back in March, there was a lot of press around the wedge, so to speak, that cheese was putting in free trade negotiations between the European Union and the U.S. as the European Commission tries to restrict the use of some cheese names by U.S. producers. Some cheese names which are pretty common in the popular American vernacular, like Parmesan, Feta, and Munster. Since 2011, the EU has put in place active free trade agreements with countries like South Korea, Colombia, Peru, and our neighbors to the north, Canada, and fellow cheese American Cheese Society member. In each of these arguments, or each of these agreements, the use of certain cheese names has been restricted. As the U.S. continues trade talks with Europe, just this past Friday, again, there was another article in the L.A. Times speaking to the role that cheese is playing in these negotiations. So, Rachel, my first question is for you. As someone who represents French cheesemakers, can you summarize this issue for us and tell us what's the big deal with what we're calling our cheeses here in the United States?
Sure, Greg. The French milk marketing board called the CNIL has a stance on this issue, and we try to look at it pragmatically. So cheeses that have historically used American or European names, we want to continue to allow them to use those names. For me, where it gets a little gray is other PDO cheeses that we do see in the U.S. but aren't as widely seen or distributed. And that is really where we're looking to sort of restrict some name calling.
PDO cheeses. Maybe you could let our listeners know what PDO stands for.
PDO stands for Protected Designation of Origin, which is supposed to represent a recipe and a quality standard of a cheese, a wine, or other ingredients that are coming from Europe. In France, it used to be called AOC, and since the unification of the European Union, we've transferred the names from AOC to PDO.
And the PDO cheeses are all protected by a consortium.
Correct.
And that consortium, are they the ones that are pushing for this these free trade agreements, or is it the EU?
So the consortiums, for the most part, have already trademarked their names. So it's an issue separate to the consortiums. It's more the EU, the larger bodies, the larger government bodies who are pushing this this issue.
So it's a naming issue, but when you say that you're pragmatic, or the French are pragmatic about this, so people that in the United States that have made cheese that they're calling Munster, that isn't Munster Alsace, but have already made it, the stance of the French I guess, government in terms of the dairy portion of the French government says that it's okay for United States makers to keep using those names.
Correct. A good example, I think, is Camembert. So we have a lot of American producers who are making Camembert. The AOC name for Camembert, or the PDO name for Camembert, is Camembert de Normandie. And Camembert de Normandie needs to be made in Normandy. It needs to be made with raw milk. You need to scoop your curd 5 times. There's very strict standards about calling your cheese Camembert de Normandie.
Yeah.
But just the name Camembert is kind of a nebulous name that you can use in the U.S. and
But Camembert refers to a place, does it not?
Well, initially, I guess it does refer to a place, but it also refers to a specific type of cheese. You know, that's what...
When you say that, what do you mean?
That there's a recipe for Camembert. There's a technique for making Camembert. Certain cultures you're supposed to use, the way you're supposed to ripen it, how you develop your cultures. And so for the ACS judging, for example, Camembert is its own subcategory within the soft ripened cheese category. So that, to me, is the challenge here, is to separate those which might just be names of cheeses or names of wines are involved in this also. But what are those that are real types of cheese? This is a type of cheese. It's made through a specific has standard of identity. Again, has a recognizable flavor, texture, whatever it is, and that's how we judge cheeses, is based on what they are. So it's a type. Again, feta is feta. Calling it something else would just be confusing.
Well, here's a question for you. So the ACS has a category of cheese that's called Camembert. Correct.
It is a subcategory. It's a subcategory. Yeah, it's a subcategory of the soft ripened cheeses.
So the cheeses are judged based on their ability to mimic that recipe accurately, or
not to imitate necessarily a Camembert de Normandie, but to bring in the characteristics that would be a Camembert versus a Brie, let's say. So it has a fruitiness, it has a specific rind development, it's an 8-ounce wheel. It's got its.
And that's where we as French producers draw the line, is the recipe versus the PDO name of Camembert de Normandie.
Yeah.
Now, when you set up the criteria for judging those, what input did you get from the people who made the original Camembert, if any?
None. Not to my knowledge. I mean, this is a rather recent development, yeah. This EU thing. And cheeses have been made for... some of these cheeses have been made for 100 years, more than 100 years, under the names that they're using. So it's a little bit late in the game for some, to change cheddar, for example, if that's on the table. You know, how would you do that?
And that's where the French Marketing Board stands, is that we don't want to change names that have historically been used in the States, but we also want to protect some of our smaller producers who are making cheese and have their cheeses have a sense of French identity in the American marketplace.
And how is it, so the people that you represent, maybe you can tell us who exactly you represent.
So I represent six of the last family-owned French producers who still export to the States. So I represent Grand Orge, who is in Normandy.
They are producers of Livarot and Pont-l'Evêque, things like that.
They also make Camembert de Normandie, and we don't do any real Camembert for the U.S. I do Jacquin, who makes ash-ripened goat cheeses in the Loire Valley. So Jacquin is still owned by the Jacquin family. Fromagerie Lancet in Burgundy. So we have Chaours, we have Delice de Bourgogne, we have Briat Savarin, we have Epoisse, we have Sumatrin. Rivoire Jacquemin, who's out in Comté, so I represent a Comté producer. Paul Duchamp, who does cheeses from Auvergne, so Saint-Nectaire, Bleu d'Auvergne, and Fum d'Ambert.
Oh, wow.
And Jean Fope, who makes Bethmal in the Pyrenees.
And these producers, they're concerned, and this is speculative, of course, they're concerned is that going forward, if a larger amount of cheeses are made in America using names that are also representative of their cheeses, that this will cause a loss of identity? Will it cause their brand to weaken, the product to be lesser, misinformation, or all of those things?
I think it's a little bit of all of that. And, especially in cheesemaking where your brand is so tied to your end product that they want to be able to know that, you know, within the, you know, the umbrella of say, Chaource, that, you know, Lancer Chaource is represented as a Lancer Chaource, and that somebody who is making Chaource outside of Champagne is not producing a product of, you know, better or lesser quality, and trying to pass it off as Chaource.
And does that happen?
It happens every once in a while. Chaource is a consortium, so we, if it does happen, we have a nice little lawyer who will write a letter to the producer asking him to not call his cheese that. And so far, everyone has been very understanding and has changed the name of their cheese.
As a retailer, how would this affect you? I mean...
Well, it's I'm not sure when you say how it would affect me, what the change the names of cheeses would be.
Well, I mean,
mammoth.
Be huge, correct?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how you would, where, you know, customer would come in and say, where is the brie? And so we can't call it brie anymore. So how would that be?
It seems like it's the opposite of when we were, you know, the U.S. government was upset with the French government, so we decided to start calling things Freedom Fries.
Yeah.
But it's the opposite of that, correct?
Well, and you want, and you don't want people to be on the opposite side. It's supposed to be working out a trade agreement here, and so we want to be on the same side as everything. And I think as a retailer, and a retailer for a long time, there's always been this tremendous respect and understanding for those protected entities, you know, that nobody here, as far as I would know, would think to call it a cheese a Chaource or to call it a Camembert du Normandy or anything that was clearly a protected name. So how do we define these cheeses? Because, again, some of them are just types of cheeses. And for us as retailers, you know, you're the same boat that Greg. That we like to point out that these are the authentic cheeses. Whether they or the authentic cheeses from Europe were here before we had this gigantic international cheese marketplace, and before we had this gigantic movement upswing in the American cheeses that we're seeing. Now, so we've always relied on and celebrated these great cheeses that have come to us from Europe. So as a retailer, it's just, to me, it's just part of the job to define these cheeses as we've always done to the consumer.
And for the French, for my producers, it is an issue of traceability, and we want you to be able to call something a cheese and know that it comes from a certain region. Where names start getting nebulous, if you just put something out as Camembert and you have, you know, 50 different producers who are making Camembert, how do you know which producer you're getting?
Right.
And so so that's where these trade laws are starting to, you know, affect.
Traceability is a big is a big issue, and that's a big word. And I've just gotten back from Italy less than 24 hours ago, and I was meeting with a consortium, the consortium that protects Prosciutto di Parma. And we spoke about traceability, but we didn't speak about it in the same way that we're talking about it now. The way that we spoke about traceability, or the biggest reason for that, was so that they could, in terms of making Prosciutto di Parma, they wanted you to know what farm that hog came from in case they had to recall those products or there was a defect. And that I can completely understand. But you're talking about a different kind of traceability, a sort of regional historical traceability.
Well, authenticity, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. So I've seen in my vast travels across the U.S., I've seen a couple cheese shops that have had ash ripened goat cheeses from the Loire Valley that I represent through Jacquin, that are calling them by their AOC name. So they're calling them Valençay, they're calling them Saint-Maur, which, if you look at it carefully, those cheeses need to be made with raw milk in order to be called those names. Now, we in the U.S. have sort of, you know, been lax about that, and we associate these pyramid or trapezoidal-shaped cheeses with Valençay and the log cheeses with reed in them as Saint-Maur, even though those are technically not their names because they are made with pasteurized milk.
Now, that brings me to a follow-up question for you. What is it the ability to call something call an object something it isn't that's most bothersome to you?
For me personally, yes.
But on a larger scale, for the people you represent, because it's a touchy subject, because you want to sell as much cheese as possible. So you're a retailer,
right? And you'll never pass a law or make a rule that will compensate for an irresponsible retailer.
No.
Never. Just
Whether they don't know what they're talking about, or whether they're genuinely misrepresenting something intentionally. Either way.
And that's why I have a job, is because my job is to educate all these people.
Right. And it's offensive to those of us retailers who try to work very hard to make sure we've got exactly what we want and that we know how to present it to our customers, you know, so that when somebody is calling something it's not, it makes us all kind of angry. But again, it's a broad brush, you know, to kind of try and compensate for this problem. And you said yourself that it's Rachel, that it's a smaller number of retailers. It's not.
No, it's a very small number of retailers.
So agreements have been reached with countries, with I believe we got South Korea, Colombia, Peru, Canada, mm-hmm. that they aren't allowed to call things. They aren't allowed to use certain names anymore.
Mm-hmm.
What about the United States?
There's been no agreement has been reached just yet. We're still in negotiations. American cheese producers are very concerned about this, rightfully so. I think.
Why do you think they're so concerned?
For any number of reasons, you know, just the economy of having to change the name of your cheese.
Well, that's a little,
you know, to change all your labeling, to change all, confusion that I think would take place on the consumer side. You know, there's a sentiment here that this will clear up things for the consumer, but the potential is there for it to do the opposite, which is that all of a sudden these cheeses that you've known for a long time have different names and different identities. That to me is a bigger potential hazard.
Yeah, I agree with that, definitely. Yeah.
It's funny, as I read through my list of the names of these cheeses that the countries agreed not to use anymore. Almost.
Well, they're importing those cheeses. They'll sell those real versions of those cheeses, but they won't import or sell other versions. Mock cheeses, right? That's what it is.
Because the names that they're using, I'll just give you an example. In Korea, non-European cheese producers can no longer sell Asiago, Feta, Fontina, or Gorgonzola. Now, those are, except for Feta, which is in this strange gray area of being a cheese from Greece that is at the center, or not the center, but that is being discussed in this free trade agreement as what is Feta? Why do we not protect that name? I believe the EU wants that name to be protected, correct?
Correct.
So other than that, they're all Italian. My whole list is just full of Italian cheeses here. Canada, same. Asiago, Feta, Fontina, Gorgonzola. But they have Munster in there too. Costa Rica, Italian producers. So it seems like the Italians are a little bit more stringent in the use of those of their name protected words, or maybe
I think there's a big tradition of Italian immigrants in the U.S. and Italian immigrants making Italian style cheese.
There
in the
is,
US.
There is definitely, and I see that all of the time. People ask me for Fontina and Gorgonzola all of the time, and without having any real clue as to where it actually comes from, what those cheeses actually represent.
Well, and I think where this situation gets, you know, very, very gray for cheesemakers is, you know, when somebody says they want Gorgonzola, when in fact they're just looking for blue cheese.
Right.
Or they're looking for Brie when, you know, they're just looking for a bloomy rind cheese, or, you know, they're looking for provolone when they want a passaflata.
It's interesting. I mean, and they do all the time.
Yeah.
People think that the word provolone covers pretty much everything.
Right.
It cut both. that's a word that just gets used, you know. And when people come to my counter at Eataly, where I work, they ask me for provolone because they have no idea what else to ask me for.
Right.
And I try to explain to them that I tell them I don't sell it, and then they look at me like I'm crazy, and I, you know, I direct them to other names of other cheeses. I mean, that's just.
And do you think that being a little stricter with names would help?
Well,
demystify things for your customers?
I do, actually. I do, but I'm torn as a retailer. I want to sell cheese, you
right.
know? So, I mean, that's why
I don't want to sell it at any cost, though. You don't want to, the truth should work best generally when you're selling something, you know, that you really just want to be able to say what it is.
You would think so. So, look, guys, we're going to have to take a short break here. But when we come back, we'll discuss this very interesting topic even further. We'll be right back. Thanks.
The Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board are proud to underwrite Cutting the Curd on heritageradionetwork.org. Wisconsin cheeses have an illustrious heritage of more than 170 years of quality and craftsmanship. During this long and rich history, the art and science of cheesemaking have been captured in time-honored traditions that produce cheese varieties of unsurpassed excellence. Today, Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit www.eatwisconsincheese.com.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome back to Cutting the Curd, live on the Heritage Radio Network. Before the break, I was talking with Rachel Perez and David G. about an important issue in the cheese industry right now. As the EU and U.S. pursue free trade talks, the use of certain cheese names by American cheesemakers, names like Parmesan, Feta, and Munster, is an important part of the negotiations. I'd like to bring the topic of geographical name protection closer to home. We do not have a system here, as they have in Europe, to protect products that are produced in certain places. Interestingly enough, there was just an article in the Wall Street Journal on Friday talking about artisan products made in Brooklyn and the global spread of Brooklyn, the brand name. The article mentions Bulgarian-made Brooklyn gin, for example. And this year, the Brooklyn Chamber of Commerce launched a certified Brooklyn-made label for local manufacturers. So what are your thoughts on this, and what do you both think the future of geographic indication in the United States, not just for cheese, but for wine and other agricultural products is, like Washington State apples or Idaho potatoes?
Well, you know, they're different things, actually, the things you just mentioned. We're putting a lot of different ingredients into the ragu here.
It's a big stew.
There's a difference between an Idaho potato and Brooklyn made. One is an agricultural designation, and the other is a branding issue. The potatoes aren't growing out of the ground in Brooklyn, you know. And so the issues facing or the challenges facing someone like Napa Valley, there's some talk about name protection for wines from there, which would make more sense as a protection because that's where the agriculture is. That's where the winemaking is. That's where the grapes grow. Brooklyn is a manufacturing center. But again, there is some agriculture going on in Brooklyn, but it's on rooftops.
Well, those are kind of the same two sides of the argument with this name protection.
So they're different. They're different issues. One is a branding exercise, which we're all for that, you know. But again, it's not to confuse it with the protection issue. That's a little bit different.
What I don't understand, and even through our first segment, is it's not completely clear to me which names the EU wants to protect. I'd like to talk about this Brooklyn thing, but I want to – is it not clear to you either as a person who represents members of the EU?
It's mostly not clear to me. I mean, I think we've all heard those same names of feta, of provolone, of gorgonzola.
Well, and there's no formal proposal on the table yet. It's like this is like a big idea that's been put out there that has some merit to it, good deal of merit to it. But
Brie and Camembert have not been put on the table.
Right.
So they haven't.
They haven't, no.
So this is just – we're just in the very preliminary stages of worry here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what about consumers? Like, you know, how does this affect consumers? I know I want to talk about Brooklyn and local things, but how does what we just discussed before the break affect consumers? We talked about how it affected retailers.
Yeah. Well, you know, we like to blame the consumer a lot for things that they don't know.
Unfortunately, I do that all the time.
But the truth of the matter is that we're in the greatest era of customer awareness in the history of the planet, you know, in the internet era. There's more information available. Sometimes there's too much misinformation available as well. But generally, you know, I have customers that come into the store and they're reading ingredient labels as if they're going to sign a prenuptial agreement.
Yeah,
they're looking at everything on the label. So I don't think that there is a real issue for, let's say, country of identity.
David, what store? Just so our listeners know, what store are you referring to?
You're these days working with Union Market in
and you have an extensive cheese selection there.
Yeah, we have about 300 cheeses in the store. You know, and people come in and they ask about the cheeses. You put all your information on your label, on your pre-cuts, and you put all your information on your signs. And then people ask ask their questions. But they're looking for the customers are coming into our store. They're looking for very specific types of cheeses. They're looking for cheeses from place. They're asking for American cheeses, or they're asking for imported cheeses, or they're asking for raw milk cheeses. So I think it's
also, do you have customers who come in and ask for feta who specifically want Greek feta?
They do sometimes.
And they ask for Greek feta.
Ask for French feta also. I mean, they'll ask for what they like or what they believe to be.
So maybe it's not
cheese.
The word feta. It just has to, the prefix has to be attached to it.
That would be the way to protect the cheese. If you really thought that Greek feta was so radically different than Bulgarian feta, you would protect Greek feta. That would be the name to protect, not just all feta. Because each country, you know, the whole concept of name protection came from before there was an EU and before there was this gigantic market.
Right.
It was to protect cheesemakers within their own countries so that people in France didn't confuse a Camembert with a Camembert de Normandy, in Italy as well, that knockoffs were didn't intrude onto those.
This is my other question about this, is that you have two separate bodies at work here in this name control issue that we are speaking of right now in regards to the 2011 initiative that the EU, where the EU, I guess, is just deciding, like, we need to clean up what people call things and get our ducks in a row. If people are going to use the names of these cheeses from our region, you know, there needs to be some accountability there. But that's a different body of regulators than the people who are the consortiums that protect these. And to me, it seems like an issue of, like, state government versus federal government.
Well, a lot of the consortiums have trademarked their names. So that in itself is a
that
whole separate
them.
Issue. They're good.
Mm. And they probably don't – well, do they even want to deal with this, or they're okay with it?
You know, I've had a couple issues, and, you know, we have a lawyer, and he'll write a nice little letter, and then generally...
But it gets cleaned up, right?
Then that's it.
And are those consortiums willing to work with... because the idea is, like, is education.
Right.
And to go along with our selling cheese. Mm-hmm. We don't want to sell cheese at any cost. We want to educate people while we do it.
Well, and I guess I have some concern also that is this rule just for other countries? Does it relate to countries within the EU as well? For example, we've been talking about Fontina as an Italian cheese, but the Danish make Fontina. Will they have to stop?
I don't know. That's very confusing to me as well, because most people who come to the counter at Eataly ask for Fontina, mm-hmm. not having any idea what I'm selling them, because the product Fontina from the Valle d'Aosta is completely different from all of these other Fontina that are out there. And I find myself really wishing that they couldn't call everything Fontina.
Well, but again, you have the cheese that's protected. That's what I enjoy telling people, actually. It's like, well, here are your choices in Fontina. This is the original Fontina. It's, no other cheese tastes like it. You give them the whole – you can tell them everything about it. It's an opportunity
to educate
the customer. You know,
it's a great way to look at it.
So that there is a difference. All Fontina – Chuck Schumer the other day said – did you see that? He said the Munster is Munster no matter how you slice it.
Yeah,
unfortunate.
I heard that.
That's not true. That's what a customer may think. And as you said early on, there's Munster that you slice, and there's Munster Hermitage, and they're different, and that's what you want to. That's the opportunity, I think, that you want with the customers to explain what they're looking for to them.
And I think part of this issue has come up in part because American cheesemaking and American consumers are getting more involved in the cheese business and buying cheese and selling cheese and producing cheese, and that as a result, that you need to have a little more traceability behind who's making what and who's calling what.
So what's the future for us in the United States with our products? Are we going to get there? Are we going to be able to name protect our products here, do you think?
Well, we're relatively brand new as a country on that scene.
We are.
Countries that have been making cheeses have been making them for hundreds and hundreds of years. So deciding what those protectable items might be is a new challenge. But
well, I think that's an interesting point, because when did name protection actually begin in Europe? You know, I mean, we're talking 20th century for all of Italy, but we know that Parmigiano has been being made since the 1100s.
Right.
So
But protection is a fairly recent.
It really is. Right.
I think it was right around World War I that it sort of started popping up. And, I mean, there's PDOs that have popped up, you know, in the last 15, 20 years, too.
So it takes a while to get there.
You need some dollars behind you.
Well, and if you're going to protect it.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. And if you're going to protect something, it really should be something that's a proven entity, not just a relatively new item. So that's almost like what we're waiting for. And, you know, in the meantime, American cheesemakers don't seem to be really wrapped up in using traditional cheese names. We're looking at hundreds of clever, different, descriptive, fun cheese names that people are
and that's
coming
mostly
up.
What I've seen is, you know, out of respect for the original cheesemakers, that a lot of Americans have just opted not to call their cheese, even though it's based on a European style, they don't call it by its European name.
Well, because in most cases, would you agree, those cheesemakers probably have learned in some way from their Europe. From the
exactly.
European,
yeah.
So they're. I think there's a fine line between.
Well, it's made that first step on that road.
Well, it's like credit. You know, you want to give credit. If you write a term paper, you need to cite your sources. So saying that I make this cheese and I call it, you know, whatever brownstone blue, right. But it's a Roquefort recipe.
Well, that's a Pleasant Ridge Reserve. It's a Beaufort recipe.
Right.
And they say that, but it's their own spin on it, and they gave it its own name.
And I mean, Spring Hill also, they make a raclette style that they changed the name from raclette to Redding.
That just happened, right?
That happened, yeah, a little while ago, 6 months ago or a year ago.
So it's interesting. I mean, this is like a kind of, and I've learned a lot just talking, it's kind of like a nebulous kind of moving parts.
Very
a lot
much
of moving,
so.
Moving parts as an argument, or not an argument, or as an issue. Because as you say, as soon as you start talking about this one thing, immediately so many other ingredients to name protection, they come in.
Yeah, that's right. And everybody kind of jumps on that bandwagon a little bit.
And especially now, I think we're all looking for labeling and certifications and all these sort of accreditations to make sure that product is actually what it's saying it is. To our consumers' benefit, and also to a certain extent to everybody's detriment, because then you are sort of confined by your label.
How do we educate retailers, you know, to put their cheeses out there properly? How do we get that? How do we, you know, regardless of any EU, I mean, so you have
perseverance.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, from a producer side, I think it's important, you know, that I've worked a lot with my producers to make sure that we're putting ingredient lists in, to make sure that we're saying whether it's pasteurized milk, whether it's raw milk, whether it's made with animal rennet, microbial rennet, vegetable rennet. You know, the more information we can get to retailers, the more information is going to hopefully get passed along.
And the retailer has, again, as we said earlier, the retailer has a real responsibility here to get that information into their own heads and then out to the customers.
Yeah, that's really where it all comes down to, where the end user, the retailer, really has that ultimate responsibility to make all of these things work, regardless of what legislation is put in place, sure. It seems.
And something like our example earlier with Gorgonzola, when somebody looks for blue, if you show them that you have Gorgonzola, but you also have other varieties of blue, I think that also educates your consumer to let them know that there is a variety of blue cheese beyond Gorgonzola.
Well, and you get this, I bet you get this all the time. People come in, they ask for Pecorino, and they're really asking for Pecorino Romano. That's really what they're looking
Absolutely.
For, but they'd just say Pecorino.
And everything is a learning opportunity. Right. I mean, I do get asked that. I get asked for when people come up and they'll ask me for two things. They'll be like, I want a Gorgonzola, but not a blue cheese. You know what I mean? I don't want any blue cheese. I don't like blue cheese, but I want a Gorgonzola.
Right.
And so I sort through that language, and you got to use all of those things as an opportunity to educate.
Right.
You know,
right.
In my horrible Italian, I'll tell people like pecorino means pecora, which means sheep, and pecorino toscano means sheep from Tuscany.
Right.
You go through all of those things.
Right.
It's a compressed environment, so as a retailer, you really have to be concise with your language. I still am not, and I'm glad we get to talk about this, but I'm still not exactly clear what cheeses the EU is trying to protect.
Well, they may not be quite clear themselves.
I don't think that they're
either,
clear
right?
themselves
they're,
either.
Again, this idea is just hitting the table.
And I think it's kind of left open so that cheeses can get put into this category or taken out, sort of.
Well, this should be a dialogue. This should be a dialogue between the countries that it's going to happen to. It shouldn't just be an edict from the EU. We should really, and if they're thinking in terms of cheeses that are already established as common names and they're not going to touch them, what else is like that?
Well, it's funny. I mean, and I'll leave you guys with one more question. So we've talked a lot here on the show about the FDA and regulations. We talked about wood boards. We talked about parts per million E. coli in milk. We've talked about many different things. But I feel like this is and will grow to be as important an issue as all of those things. And I was wondering if you guys agreed with me on that.
Oh, I
and if
think it
so,
falls,
why?
It falls right in line with that. So Morbier, for example, right now, Morbier is not allowed in the U.S. because of the bacteria counts. But you go into, one in every three retailers still has
still
a Morbier-style cheese in their case that is, when it comes into the States, when it's on your invoice, it'll say whatever the name of the cheese is, Morbier-style. But then when it gets put out for customers, they're still using an actual Morbier sign.
Yeah.
So the names need to equal the science, need to equal the history, needs to equal the traceability. It all needs to be circular in that way.
I think that's why we're all employed.
Oh, that's fantastic. So we learned a couple things here on the show today. We learned that it's unclear exactly what the EU wants to regulate. But we also learned that this is an important issue.
Well, this would be the opportunity to get it right.
Exactly. And it's a big opportunity for retailers to sort of clean up their signage and start selling people, actually, what's on the tag. If you'd agree with me on that.
Totally.
And the consumer is not to blame.
Never.
So I want to thank both of you guys, Rachel and David, for coming on with me today to discuss this important topic. And I look forward to maybe having you guys back, and we'll talk more about name control issues and cheese in general
as they develop.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Have a good one.
This is Greg, your host of Cutting the Curd. We'll be back next week. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.